So we're privileged to have with us Rabbi Mordechai Morty Schwartz. He currently serves as director of the Beit Midrash at JTS. He heads the Nishma Summer Program, and he serves as an assistant professor of Talmud and Rabbinics at JTS and the research coordinator for the Center for Pastoral Education at JTS. He's past recipient of the prestigious Professor Saul Lieberman and Dr. Judith Berlin Lieberman graduate fellowships in Talmudic studies. He's also an alumnus.
That was nice. That was like 5 years of basically, you know, being able to do nothing but study. That was very nice.
Oh, my gosh. A dream.
Yeah.
He is also an alumnus of the University of Nebraska.
Yeah.
Rabbi Schwartz has taught at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. He's written articles for the Encyclopedia Judaica Online and the Cambridge Dictionary of Judaism and Jewish Culture. The findings of his research on rabbinic travel and pilgrimage in the Talmud, titled As They Journeyed from the East, the Nehote of the 4th century and the construction of the rabbinic diaspora, was published in the Hebrew Union College Annual. And his new book, Rewriting the Talmud, on the effect of tradition from Land of Israel on the composition of the Babylonian Talmud, is forthcoming from Moore Zebeck.
If I can get the spacing right, that's apparently what I'm working on now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So yeah. So my research is mostly about travel between the two rabbinic centers and the passage of information between the two rabbinic centers, Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael in late antiquity, mostly in the 4th century. So very interesting stuff. I talked a little bit about that the last time that I was here. I'm not going to talk about that tonight. Tonight I'm wearing my other hat. The other career I was thinking about or fantasizing about when I was in my early 20s was film. And I thought I very seriously considered going to film school for a short period of time, briefly. But I'm still a movie buff, and I have to say, for me, Pesach is always associated with the Ten Commandments. I grew up watching it every single year on the TV, and it projects a certain image or a certain vision of Yitziat Mitzrayim, of the Exodus from Egypt, and I was surprised, I guess I would say, when I read the actual account in Exodus when I was in college, and much of that material was absent. The best line in the movie, for instance, is, "As it is written, so shall it be done," which sounds like a biblical verse, but isn't. So there are a range of different things. The key relationship in that movie is the relationship between these two brothers, Moses and Ramses, and there's this rivalry going on. And in fact, in later depictions later cinematic depictions of the Exodus, this always becomes the central thematic relationship, and the choice of a nation over the choice of family, which is actually really fascinating. And it's about ideation and creating an individual identity, I think, is what the narrative is about there, which is really fascinating. And it's fascinating that it's actually not present in the Bible in the way that we think of it being present. Although I'm gonna see if we can't find some level of subtle hints within the biblical text and the Midrash and the Talmud to talk about these things. I am going to, I should say this by way of what you should expect tonight. I am going to show you some clips from these films. I'm going to talk about the clips. We're going to read some texts, which are interesting texts. And by the end of the evening, I will have made the themes that we find in these films problematic versus vis-a-vis the biblical text. Right, that these are things that may or may not actually be there, and then I'm also going to try and affirm them to some degree as well. So you should walk out of here with a subtle, nuanced view of what's going on here, which I think is probably right. Okay, so the first thing I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to show you a short clip from the original Ten Commandments, which is from the 1920s. Cecil B. DeMille's original Ten Commandments is surprising. I was very surprised when I saw it because it bears very little relationship to the remake in the 1950s. So if you see, for instance, The Man Who Knew Too Much, right, which Alfred Hitchcock made twice, it's basically the same movie. Some changes that are based upon time, you know, one's in black and white, one's in color, they're changing location, but basically the same plot and same movie. One's made in the 1930s, one's made in the 1950s. Here you would expect a similar kind of thing, late 20s to 1950s, but in fact it's a completely different movie with different themes, and really the characters are quite different. Now there are some elements that are borrowed, and I want to show you those as well, but I want to do is I want to just take a quick look at this and show you how surprising this is. Oh, shoot. Went all the way back to the beginning? Oh, that's too bad. Am I going to have to do this every single time? Let's see if it pushes play. What happens? Does it go back to Noah? See, I have all these movies on here, clips to show you different things, but... Well, there we go. Let's see if it starts. Yeah, it's going all the way back to the beginning. Ah. You know what I'll do? Oh, no, it's not. This is it. Can everyone see? Should I move out of the way? This is silent, by the way. What's the music they're using, by the way?
Call Me Dre.
Yes, Max Brooks' Call Me Dre. Right, that's the original music, which is actually really interesting. Of course, originally it would have been played on an organ in the movie theater. I just want to say, this is near the beginning of the movie, right? What he's trying to get to is the revelation at Sinai. That's actually going to be very important later on. Kid in the biblical accounts? No, but he's going to be in all the poems and novels.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it's a way of getting the dancing girls in, right? I'm gonna skip this part because it's not so necessary for us. I think that was the part I really wanted to hear. Oh, I did skip that part. Good, perfect. So
fantastic. So there are a number of elements here that I think are like really crucial and important that stand out. One is this the first of the meetings with Pharaoh, or is this a later meeting with Pharaoh? If you were just watching the movie, what would you think? So you, because you know the biblical account. If you didn't know the biblical account, and apparently, does it seem like they're meeting him for the first time, or they're not meeting him for the first time? Right? It's the first time that they've actually met Pharaoh in the movie, which is really very interesting, even though 9 plagues have already occurred, which is really fascinating. The other thing that's fascinating is the threat of the firstborn, but he's trying to compress things. You'll note he brought a verse from chapter 5 and then later a verse from chapter 11. He's trying to compress things. The other thing is there a relationship, a sibling relationship between Moses and Pharaoh here? None at all. None at all. It actually really reflects the way that the biblical text itself actually works and functions. The question is, if you read the biblical text, if you didn't know the later movies that we're going to see, does Moses have a sibling relationship with Pharaoh at all? And the answer is, from the biblical text, it seems like he doesn't. Not at all. And the relationship with Pharaoh is an antagonistic one, which is really what you see here as well. What I wanted to do now before we go on and we take a look at this next clip is I want to actually stop and take a look at several of these texts, and we'll read a little bit from Shemot. We'll look at a passage that is probably relatively familiar to you from Shemot Rabbah, and then hopefully we'll look at a couple, maybe one or two other passages, and we'll see what's going on. Okay, so let's do this, and we will sort of try and uncover what mystery is going on here. Okay, so I'm gonna just fill you in very briefly. Right after Moses is discovered by Pharaoh's daughter in the bulrushes, I made 15. I figured that would be enough. How many people do we have? We have more than 15 people. Are gonna have to share a little bit.
Here.
So fine. So after she discovers Moses in the bulrushes, she wants to take him in. Does she take him back to her house is the question at that point, according to the biblical text? No, she doesn't. What does she do? That's exactly right. She says that Miriam, you know, sort of comes up and says, "I know a Hebrew woman who can nurse the child," and she sends him off. And then apparently we have in immediately afterwards in verse 10 of chapter 2 the following verse. Elisa, you want to read for us? Chapter 2, verse 10, the very first source.
In English.
Yeah.
When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, who made him her son. She named him Moses, explaining, "I drew him out of the water."
Right. So this is the totality we get of Moses' childhood in Pharaoh's house growing up. That's it. That's all we get. Immediately afterwards, it repeats, Vayigdal Moshe, and Moses grew up. That's the only difference between the two verses, Vayigdal HaYeled versus Vayigdal Moshe, right, that Moses grew up. And why? Because he only got his name in verse 10. In verse 11, he's now Moses, and Moses grows up, and he goes out, and he sees his brothers, the Israelites, who apparently he knows. Apparently he knows he's an Israelite, and that his brothers are Israelites. There's a lot missing here. Like, there's a big gap. What happened in all those years in between when he's in Pharaoh's palace? How is it that he behaves? How does Pharaoh behave towards him? All of those things, they're all absent here. And in fact, this is something that you know, the Midrashic tradition, when there's a gap, wants to step in and fill it in and sort of imagine, well, what was that experience like? These films do the same thing, actually, in terms of imagining what Moses' childhood and youth are like. But let's take a look and see what the Midrashic tradition does. So it's quoting, it's taking a look at this same verse, right? So this is Shemot Rabbah, yeah, so what happens?
And the child Moses grew 24 months she nursed him, and you say, and the child grew? Rather, he grew not in the way of the rest land.
Right. In other words, he grew extraordinarily fast. He became mature in 2 years. He became, you know, sort of a full youth or something like this. Yeah.
And she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh. The daughter of Pharaoh would kiss and hug and adore him, Moses, as if he were her own son, and she would not take him out of the king's palace. And because Moses was so beautiful, everyone yearned to see him. One that would see him would not leave his presence. And it was that Pharaoh would kiss him, Moses, and hug him, and he would remove Pharaoh's crown and place it on his own head, as he would do to him in the future when he was great.
Okay, so stop there for a second. So there is this ancient story that they have about Moses as a baby removing Pharaoh's crown and placing it on his own head, right? And you can imagine a baby doing this with a king. This is actually
did that to the Pope the other day.
What'd you say?
Yeah,
a young
right.
Child
really.
Photo.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic, right? So you can imagine this. This story appears in Josephus and at least one other Second Temple account. So it's a relatively old story. It doesn't fit so nicely with the first part where Moses is supposed to be like sort of more of a grown child. But you can sort of see how two things are being sort of put together here in this interesting way. But in any case, the idea here is that this is kind of prophetic, a sign of what's to come, that Moses is going to overcome Pharaoh's power. So what happened here?
Just as the Holy One left, as he said to Hiram, I have brought fire from within you. It will consume you. Similarly, the daughter of Pharaoh raised the one who would punish her father in the future.
I'm not going to worry about Hiram so much, but you get the idea, right? In other words, your own child will usurp you, right? Okay, this is a common kind of mythology also. Okay, so fine. So continue on.
And even the anointed king that is...
Well, let's skip a little bit there. And there, some of the observers sitting among them were magicians of Egypt. That said,
we are wary of this, that he is taking your crown and placing it on his head, that he not see the one we say, prophecy, that will take the kingship from you. Some said to kill him, and some said to burn him. And Jethro was sitting among them.
Okay, so this is important. Jethro. Who's Jethro? He's Moses' future father-in-law. What's he doing there sitting with in the court in Egypt, right? So there is this notion that they have that there are these three figures who are around. Oh, you made more photocopies for me? Thank you. I appreciate that very, very much. So there's this notion that they have that there are these three counselors that Pharaoh has that actually all appear in various parts of the Bible. So Jethro, right? He's the Kohen of Midian. He's the priest of Midian. And so as an important person, of course, Pharaoh would bring him in as an advisor. So he's there, right? And then we also have Bilam ben Beor, right? Who is the prophet, the foreign prophet who Balak brings to curse Israel later in the book of Numbers. And he's also supposed to be one of Pharaoh's advisors. And then there's a third advisor who is Job, actually. Yov is considered to be at the same time. He's from Eretz Utz. He's not an Israelite, and he's supposed to be at the same time, or at least the rabbis imagine him being at the time period of Pharaoh. And so what you have is this same sort of rabbinic hierarchy that goes on. It's not in this part, but it's earlier on. This idea that, in fact, there's one good advisor, one indifferent advisor, and one evil advisor. Jethro is the good advisor, right? Job is the indifferent advisor, and Bilam is the evil advisor. And this fits the way that they're thought of later on. Obviously, Jethro is a good figure later on. He's Moses' father-in-law. He's a very positive figure. And then you have, Bilam being an evil figure later on. The Israelites actually kill him. He tries to curse Israel. And then they also manage to solve an interpretive problem with this, right? Job was innocent. He didn't do anything. Why should all these bad things happen to him? Because he didn't do anything, right? You understand? Right? In other words, he could have saved Israel, and he didn't. He didn't budge one inch. And so they're able to talk about sort of inaction, being a cause for punishment as well, which is a really fascinating, interesting thing. But in any case, this story is told lots of different ways. This particular story here in Shmot Rabbah, you actually have Jethro making the suggestion of how to test the infant Moses. But in the Tanhuma, you actually get Bilam, the evil advisor, who's actually making this suggestion. So let's hear what the suggestion is. And this will be Sunday school familiar to you. Go ahead.
So Jethro was sitting among them and said to them, "This child has no intent to take the throne. Rather, test him by bringing in a bowl, a piece of gold, and a coal. If he outstretches his hand toward the goal, surely he has intent to take the throne, and you should kill him. And if he outstretches his hand toward the coal, he surely does not have intent to take the throne, and he does not deserve the death penalty." They immediately brought the bowl before him, Moses, and he outstretched his hand to take the gold, and Gabriel came and pushed Moses' hand, and he grabbed the coal.
By the way, what would most babies take? The shiny thing or the hot thing, right? Yeah, that's which is like really surprising. Okay, that this is the test. Okay, fine. So Gabriel saves him. What happens then?
He then brought his hand along with the coal into his mouth and burned his tongue, and from this was made slow of speech and slow of tongue. And she called his name Moshe. From here, you can learn about the merit of those that perform acts of kindness. Even though Moses had many names, the only name that was set throughout the Torah was the name that Batya, daughter of Pharaoh, called him. Even the Holy One, blessed is he, did not call him by another name.
Okay, so there are a couple of things going on. First of all, the story about the gold and the coal, how many people have heard that before? Yeah, pretty universal stories. As famous as Abraham and the idols, right? Some of these stories have a great deal of currency. This story doesn't occur in any of the movie accounts. One of the things that's actually really interesting in the movie accounts, Moses doesn't have a speech impediment. None of them does Moses have a speech impediment, which is really fascinating and interesting. On the other hand, we actually have something here that one sees immediately, which is that Moses seems to be, even in this midrash, kind of shooting for the crown of Egypt, right? In other words, there's this notion that Moses is going to take away the Egyptian crown. Just to sort of purposes of continuity, is this the Pharaoh that Moses eventually faces during the negotiations to get the children of Israel out of Egypt?
No,
it's not.
It's
how do I know? How do I know that it's one generation earlier? Go ahead. That's right. That's exactly right. And we're going to take a look at that. In other words, the Torah itself is explicit at the end of chapter 2 that Pharaoh that he had escaped from is now dead, that he died. And the children of Israel at that point call out to God, and God is going to arrange for Moses to save them. And at the end of chapter 4, we also see again that God, when he speaks to Moses to tell him to go back to Egypt, he says, all of the people who were trying to kill you before, they're all dead now, and you can go back, which is actually rather interesting. We also don't get a sense with the new Pharaoh of what the relationship is between them. Apparently Moses is able to get into him somehow without any trouble, and the Midrash has to deal with that as well. But in fact, there's no description of what that relationship is or what it might be. Is there any brother figure, by the way, in this particular Midrash? No. And there are almost no accounts of other princes that are around in any of the Midrashim or any of the stories. I say almost none, because you actually do have an obscure Second Temple text, I guess you would say, which actually describes this event happening at a banquet where the other princes are around, and Moses pulls the crown off, and of course it's not just Pharaoh that's at issue, it's also the other princes, because he's sort of stepping in to that position. But that's not how the rabbinic account goes at all. So in fact, since you said it, do you see this 223 there? Can you read? What's your name, by the way?
Barry.
Barry, please.
A long time after that, the king of Egypt died, the Israelites were groaning under the bondage and cried out, and they cried for help from the
Right. So in other words, we have one pharaoh dying, right, and a new pharaoh coming. Although here they call him Melech Mitzrayim. They go back and forth between pharaoh, Raparo, and Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt, right? They use both epithets, which is actually very interesting also in the context of what's Moses' name, right? Moses has multiple names according to the Midrashic account, right? Moshe, right, is a recognizable Egyptian name, right? So you actually have, for instance, Ramsha is Ramses, right? So Mashe means son of, it means son, something like that, right? Tutmoses, right? Tutmoshe, right? So this name, right, the Kimin Amayim Mishituhu, is an attempt to turn, right, I drew him out of the water, is an attempt to turn that into a Hebrew meaning. But it actually is recognizable, and I think it would be recognizable to Israelites listening. Not only that, but I think it's recognizable to the rabbis, which is why they say he's always called by his Egyptian name. Throughout, he's always called by his Egyptian name. Surely his, you know, Hebrew mother, Yocheved, must have given him a Hebrew name, right? Right. In fact, the names are hugely important to the rabbis. That's one of the things they say is the reason the Jews are redeemed is because among other things, they don't change their names. So they actually take this event that occurs early on when Moses is born, and his mother looked at him, and it says, "V'tere ki tovhu," right? And she saw that he was good. What's his name? Tuvia, right? His name is you know, the good kid, right? The good one of God, right? So that's actually one of the multiple Hebrew names that they give. There are a whole bunch of other names as well, but they make the point. Oh, he's called by his Egyptian name his entire life, which is actually really very interesting, because it speaks to a kind of Egyptian identity that's going on as well. You do get the sense from this Midrashic material that he is immersed in Pharaoh's house, that he grows up in Pharaoh's house, that he has, you know, at least a quasi-Egyptian identity, and that there's a process of coming to terms with that identity that's going to have to happen.
Were there chemicals Batya in the Torah?
No, Batya appears, that's the name that appears in the Book of Chronicles. When it actually, the Book of Chronicles actually is very, one of the things it's obsessed with is genealogy. You know, genealogy can become an obsession, for an ancient obsession and a modern obsession as well. So they list, they give lots and lots of different names to characters who don't have names in the earlier biblical accounts. Bitya actually is the way that it's pointed there. But the rabbis, when they adopt it, they call her both Bitya and Batya, and they're able to use that name for the daughter of Pharaoh. It makes sense, by the way, also that she's Bat Paro. Right, so she can't be Bat Paro any longer once she converts and marries Caleb, right, which is what the rabbinic, you know, sort of imagination has her doing. So therefore, she must change her name from Bat Paro to Batya, right, God's daughter, right? So which is actually a very interesting sort of you know, change going on. But of course, absent here is any relationship between the brother. And if you note with the material I showed you before from the original Cecil B. DeMille film, that in fact there is no relationship, no indication that they're brothers here as well in that first film. What happens between this film and the one in the 1940s? You know what happens? There's a bestseller that's published that people don't remember at all anymore, which is called the Tablets of the Law. It was published by Thomas Mann in 1944, and it was the first account that depicted Moses and Ramses as brothers in rivalry for the leadership of Egypt. And it actually depicts Moses as the actual son of Pharaoh's daughter, that she is impregnated by a Hebrew, and that therefore he's kind of this mixed Hebrew-Egyptian identity. But I think what happened is that because it was a very, very popular book, and I think that Cecil B. DeMille read the book, and he's like, oh, that's a really good idea. I think I'll adopt that. And every movie since then has adopted that. Now, I want you to when I show you this next clip, I want you to note A whole range of different things. Which things are?
She had sex. She didn't
know.
He's a foundling. I found
yeah.
him.
That's the 1950s. Let's see if I can get to come up.
Oh, you mean...
There were two. There were two. Cecil B. DeMille did two. The 1920s. No, the book is from the 40s.
He gave me an idea.
Yes, exactly right. Let's see if I can get this to start now. Why is this not starting? Oh, because I'm pushing the wrong button. Can everyone see?
The gift of Troy is a fabulous fabric from the land of the five rivers.
Our thanks to Priya. It is fabulous indeed.
It shimmers like the Nile. What is it?
How is it made? No one knows, great Pharaoh. It is spun on the looms of the gods. They call it silk.
The ambassador from Jericho.
What kingdom has sent you?
Kingdom of the Most High.
These must be ambassadors for India,
What gifts do you bring?
We bring you the Word of God.
Don't forget, there's a rivalry. There's a love triangle between Moses, Ramses, and this woman.
What is this word?
Thus saith the Lord God of Israel. Let my people go.
Slaves are mine. Lives are mine. All that they own is mine. I do not know your God, nor will I let Israel go.
Who are you to make their lives bitter in hard bondage? Man shall be ruled by law, not by the will of other men.
Who is this God that I should let your people go?
Aaron. Cast down thy staff before Pharaoh. He may see the power of God.
In this you shall know that the Lord is God.
Special effect.
You gave me this staff to rule over scorpions and serpents, but God made it a rod to rule over kings. Hear his word, Ramses, and obey. Obey?
Moses, Moses. Are there no magicians in Egypt? You have come back to make serpents out of snakes. Or cause the rabbits to live here.
He liked that moment so much from the 22, from the
Cuban
film from the
20s. Greater wonder to perform. Tear it before your idol people and bid them make bricks without straw.
How can people make bricks without straw?
Let his staff provide them with it. Or let them glean straw in the fields for themselves. And their tally of bricks shall not diminish. Or let it be written. Or let it be done.
Okay. Put that on pause.
Let's see.
Okay. So fine. So then here there is a relationship between them. Like they know each other. And in fact they have this kind of nasty sibling rivalry. It's not a loving relationship. It's that they're in rivalry for the being the king of Egypt. And Ramses was able to manipulate things in at some point in the past to get Moses kicked out. If you watch the movie, it's actually really interesting how the way that all of this works out. But this is the depiction really of Ramses that you find in Mann's novel, and he brings it to the screen, and that's actually what's going on here. There is no indication or hint of this at all in the biblical text, and even in the Midrashic material when they're talking about Moses' Egyptian character, you don't get a sense that the other princes have one feeling one way or the other about Moses, or that there's any familiarity that Moses has with Pharaoh. So what I'd like to do now is actually take a look at Exodus 5, and we can look at how this is basically, this scene is the scene from Exodus 5. And we can actually see how DeMille is incorporating material from here and also material from Mann's novel. So let's see here. We're moving around. So Ron, maybe you want to read for it?
Maybe the evil.
Okay. Well, why don't we keep it in English at this point here, and we can see if we can. Okay.
Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a festival for me in the wilderness."
Okay. By the way, any indication of how Moses gets in front of Pharaoh? Right. I would presume that it's kind of hard to get in to see Pharaoh. Here he has to go in, you know, there's a delegation, and there are all these other foreign delegations from Troy and Jericho and all these other places. This is the imagination of the great, powerful Pharaoh. And here he kind of like just walks in. Okay. Continue on.
But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should heed him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go."
So that idea, who is the Lord, we actually did hear that. But this, what he says is, they're mine, the slaves are mine, it's all mine, right? What you don't actually get here. Okay, so fine. So go ahead.
They answered, "The God of the Hebrews has manifested himself to us. Let us go, we pray, a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he strike us with pestilence or sword."
Right. This is their starting out negotiation position, is we're just going to go for 3 days. Right? And that's what you actually have here. And it continues consistently, and it slowly they build up their demands. But in this, they're immediately, right away, they're like, let him go.
You didn't comment on what has been added here is this American concept of rule of law.
Yes.
Which is not the same as rule of God.
That's exactly correct. And I think there is a Cold War feeling that's actually going on there. There's also the importance of the nuclear family, which is the other element that's going on here. There's the attempt to pull at the heartstrings. In both cases is this attempt to say that Pharaoh has, you know, an actual family. The dramas that are here are family dramas on the one hand, and on the other hand, the political drama, even though it's sort of gestured at, is in fact this question of rule of law. I think throughout the 1950s there is in movies this attempt to sort of have an underlying political drama that's gestured to rather than made, you know, completely explicit on the screen. But yes, that's a message we can get. Everybody understands it. Everybody understands it. That's exactly right. Okay. So let's see what happens here. Okay.
"The king of Egypt said to them, 'Moses and Aaron, why do you distract the people from their tasks? Get to your labors.' And
yeah.
Pharaoh continued, 'The people of the land are already so numerous, and you would have them cease from their labors.' That same day, Pharaoh charged the taskmasters and foremen of the people, saying, 'You shall no longer provide the people with straw for making bricks, as heretofore. Let them go and gather straws for themselves, but impose upon them the same quota of bricks as they have been making heretofore. Do not reduce it, for they are shirkers. That's why they cry, 'Let us go sacrifice to our God.'"
Right. Okay. So we're not going to read the rest of the chapter because it goes on in great detail talking about the quota and how they had to how hard it was for the Israelites to go out and gather the straw, etc., etc., etc. What is missing, which is actually there in the biblical account in chapter 6, but it's not there in chapter 5. It's a second visit. It's a second visit where they bring the staff and the sign of the staff, right, and the staff turning into the snake. But it's the same. It happens in the same meeting here. In Cecil B. DeMille's movie, he's compressed it, right? It's happened in the same meeting, and we're going to see a number of things when we look at Prince of Egypt in a second. One of the things that we're going to see is that they keep a lot of the elements from DeMille's movie. They keep that it's Moses and Ramses, right? They have a slightly different relationship. But they also keep this idea that at the first meeting you have the snake, which is actually really very interesting. They actually have the special effects to do the snake properly, which is a whole other story. But I think it's fascinating that one of the things that's coming through here is this rivalry between Moses and Ramses, and that becomes really the central motif of the way that we think about it. That's always what I thought was in the biblical text when I was growing up. Yeah.
Question. The first example showed Moses as a non-heroic figure. He didn't look heroic.
That's right.
Of course, we didn't hear him, but it was not an impression of a heroic, regal person. In the second example...
Yeah.
I mean, the star quality of the actor is part of that.
That's
as well.
Right. That's right.
But there's this heroic competition, and you really believe that there might be some advantage sometime in the future.
Yes. Well, we're gonna see that idea really emphasized when we get to this latest movie that came out. I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, which is called Exodus: Gods and Kings, where you have it's Moses as Batman. It's really an action film, and they actually have, it's actually Christian Bale who's playing Moses. It's an action movie star, right? So, I think you're absolutely right, and we're moving towards that. The question is, how is Moses depicted in Prince of Egypt, which we're going to see in a second? He's a much skinnier figure than Charlton Heston. Now the question is it that they want him to be skinny with long hair and a beard because they're trying to appeal to Christians with the second movie as well? So you should keep that in mind as well. Why don't we take a look at this? I want you to keep that in mind, and we'll look at the Hulin material after that because I think it's going to be really relevant. Okay, so let's take a look here.
My heart is out, brother. Yeah. But things cannot be as they were.
I see no reason why not.
You know I am a Hebrew. And the God of the Hebrews came to me.
What?
He commands that you let his people go. Behold, the power of God.
Saw that, Sacrament. must see smiles on our faces. You'll know what power is when we are gone, son. You're playing with the big boys now.
Oh, that's pretty.
Every spell and gesture tells you all for the best.
You're playing with the big boys now. You're playing with the big boys now. You're playing with the big boys now. Stop this foolish vision.
Watch the true magician.
Give that exhibition how.
Pick up your silly tooth.
Who's missing?
Aaron.
Aaron's gone, completely gone, absent. Why is Aaron gone? What? Why is he not there?
No speech impediment.
There's no speech impediment, and that's exactly right. None of these movies have a speech impediment, and that's going to carry through. I'm not going to show a clip from Exodus: Gods and Kings because I couldn't get a nice clip. But it's a lot of action. You should see the movie, but it's not as good a movie as the other two. The other two are actually very good movies. I think so anyway. Even if you think that Charlton Heston's a bit stiff, yeah. The same thing's true. The same thing's true with Prince of Egypt. Now, it absolutely is right. There were Christian and Jewish scholars who were consultants. For instance, Bert Vazotsky, who teaches at JTS, was actually a consultant on Prince of Egypt. Now, that said, the fact that they have consultants, right, doesn't mean that they listen to them. That's exactly right. So the other piece of this is it has to function and work as a movie. Right, and what that means is writers decide on a plot and what themes they want to actually depict. So one issue is that the speech impediment is terribly, terribly inconvenient, right? Because you can't have a person speaking with a speech impediment for an hour and a half or 3 hours of a movie. It's going to be impossible for people to watch, or at least that's the thought, right? That's number one. Number two is, if I'm going to depict a sibling rivalry, if that's going to be my central theme, it's inconvenient to have another brother. Right? And so I want to eliminate that relationship. But the relationship that's the sibling rivalry that actually exists, or I could say semi-friendly sibling rivalry that actually exists between two brothers in the book of Exodus, and for that matter continuing in to the book of Leviticus and Numbers, is the rivalry between Moses and Aaron. Right? And not only that, but a rivalry between Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, apparently. And so there's this ongoing feud that continues throughout the family that's really there. It's really present. In fact, in the coming week's Parsha, you have the very last time that Moses actually performs an animal sacrifice. And the reason is because it's the sacrifice that initiates Aaron into the priesthood, and only Aaron can do sacrifices from that point. Right at that moment where he sacrifices the animal, there's a cantillation mark that occurs only four times in the Torah. That shall show it. That's exactly right. And what that depicts is this moment of hesitation, right? Where he realizes that he's giving up power. He's ceding power to Aaron, which is actually really fascinating. But to have that actually present in any one of these movies, to have Aaron there as anything but a flat sop, right? And an unnecessary character by the time you get over here, is going to create this kind of strange strain in the central story which I'm telling, which is this rivalry between Moses and Aaron. The Moses and Ramses, I mean to say. So now the question also about this is, you're right that Cecil B. DeMille consulted with scholars. It wasn't just biblical scholars that he consulted with, right? The Egyptology occurs there and here is really, really prevalent, right? The idea is to create a real Egyptian, right, sort of air. And there's this intense desire for production design to reflect, you know, the Egyptian world that they're functioning in. I'm not sure that that's actually what's going on in the biblical text, right? The focus isn't on Pharaoh. The focus is on the relationship between God and Moses and how does God get the people out. There are these ongoing negotiations with Pharaoh, but again and again and again, Pharaoh's like a flat character, a really flat character throughout the book of Exodus. He's there basically to say no, and to say yes sometimes and then change his mind and say no, so that we can keep having more and more and more plagues. Right? And in fact, the amount of time that you spend on the relationship between Moses and Pharaoh versus the amount of time that the plagues themselves are actually described, that the miracles are actually described, is really inconsonant. It's a much smaller amount of time spent on negotiations and a much larger amount of time spent on describing the plagues. Now in these movies, both the Ten Commandments and also this movie here, how do they depict the Ten Plagues? Through montage. Right? What does montage do? It is an attempt to edit scenes together in a way that your mind fills in the gaps so that I can speed the story along. And so what I do is I just sort of make my way through the plagues without actually... Because what's the point? What am I trying to emphasize? It's an opportunity for special effects. The plagues are much more paid attention to in Exodus, Gods, and Kings because they're action. But you understand, if you're trying to create a movie that's about relationships and sibling rivalry and the rivalry between these figures, that's what you're going to focus on. That's what you're definitely going to end up focusing on. So fine. So then what we have here, I think that is consonant and the same between the Midrashic text that we saw before and the movies, is this idea of Moses as an Egyptian. Right? That Moses is somehow immersed in the household of Pharaoh. His name remains Egyptian. He perhaps is going to usurp Pharaoh. And so there is this sense of Moses as being very Egyptian, and that he's that the world he lives is an Egyptian world. When we get to the Talmud here, we're going to see that actually changes. We're going to see that in fact what's going to happen is we're going to group non-Jewish rulers into a single category, and we're going to group Jewish rulers into, or Jewish prophets, Jewish leaders into a single category. And then what we're going to do is we're going to say Moses and Aaron, they in fact are the paradigm of Jewish leadership. So let's go ahead and take a look at that. We've been moving around here. Do I have a volunteer to read over there? Someone want to read? You're going to make me call? Okay, please, go ahead. So let's take a look at Chulin. This is from the Babylonian Talmud. And so as a result, this text here at the bottom of page 5 is a text which is much better known, I guess you would say, than you would think it would be much better known. So let's, in fact, you may not have seen it before. So let's go ahead.
Rabbi Yochanan said, in the name of Rabbi Eleazar, son of Rabbi Shimeon.
Yeah, yeah.
Wherever you find the words of Rabbi Eleazar, the son of Rabbi Galilean and the Nagada, make your ear like a funnel.
Okay, so in other words, whenever he talks, right, was it E.F. Hutton talks?
Yeah,
people listen, right? So okay, so fine.
For he said, it is written, it was not because you were greater than any people that the Lord set his love love upon you and chose you.
Yeah, so that's I gave that verse over here, but you know, it's the same verse. We don't have to really pay a lot of attention to reading it in its original context. Okay, so fine.
Reading
or go, no, please go ahead and keep reading.
The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Israel, I love you because even when I bestow greatness upon you, you humble yourselves before me.
Okay, right. So in other words, God grants greatness to Jewish leaders. Jewish leaders respond with humility, right? That's the idea, okay? By the way, just to say this, you know, Emil Durkheim, the only reason you tell people something is because they're not doing it. You understand what I mean by that? Okay, so let's go ahead and see what happens.
I bestowed greatness upon Abraham, yet he said to me, I am but dust and ashes. Upon Moses and Aaron, yet they said, and we are nothing. Upon David, yet he said, but I am a worm and no man. But with the heathens, it is not.
Okay, so before we go to the idolaters, let's take a quick look at what actually is going on in both Deuteronomy 7 through 9 and also in Exodus 16, 7 through 8. So let's take a look first in Deuteronomy. That's this thing about it's not because you're the greatest of nations that I chose you. So go ahead and read that for us. It's the second source on page 7. Yeah.
7-7-9? Mm-hmm. 7-9. It is not because you are the most numerous of peoples that the Lord set his heart on you and chose you. Indeed, you are the smallest of peoples. But it was because the Lord favored you and kept the oath he made to your fathers that the Lord freed you with a mighty hand and rescued you from the house of bondage, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know, therefore, that only the Lord your God is God, the steadfast God, keeps his covenant faithfully to the thousandth generation of those who love him and keep his commandments.
Right, and the what we get here very clearly is the idea, it's not about you, it's about the love I had for your forefathers, and I'm in rivalry with who? God is in rivalry with who? With Pharaoh, right? The power of Pharaoh can't stand up. Only God, only Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is God, and Pharaoh isn't, right? Because Pharaoh sort of does see himself, or the Egyptian mythology sees Pharaoh as a god who is powerful. And you see that again and again and again throughout the biblical text, that God is more powerful than Pharaoh, which is actually a really interesting thing that it needs to be said. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Even though we've seen numerous pharaohs die, mm-hmm. There's only one god, and it's back to life.
Yes,
so there
they're invested. They're invested with the quality of Pharaoh.
Is there
yeah.
A weakness of the Pharaoh?
No. So I think the idea is that the spirit of Pharaoh passes from one Pharaoh to the next. That it's invested in them as they become Pharaoh, and so you have this dual quality or this dual nature, right? The human being who possesses that position, and then Pharaoh, who is an ongoing powerful continuity. Okay. Yeah. They do in fact have an afterlife. But the interesting thing is that Pharaoh it continues to rule as Pharaoh, which is why one of the reasons I think that the Torah refers to him all the time as Pharaoh. You do get Sanhariv later on in the Book of Kings as a personal name for the Pharaoh. But this is a later dynasty, and I think that the theology of who Pharaoh is has actually changed at that point. It's actually very interesting. Okay, anyway, let's take a look here then, and we'll see Moses and Aaron in their moment of humility here at the bottom of page 7. So go ahead and read and see. We'll see the context there.
And in the morning you shall behold the presence of the Lord, because he has heard your grumblings against the Lord.
What's the context here? In the morning you'll see, what are you going to see? You're going to see the manna falling from heaven. That's actually the context in chapter 16. Okay?
For who are we that you should grumble against?
Yeah, so v'nachnu ma is actually what is being translated there as we are nothing, right? And so you're going to see the rest of this is about the quail and the manna, right? It's going to be the Lord who's going to give you flesh to eat in the evening and bread in the morning because he heard your complaints against him, right? In other words, what can we do? We can't do anything. We're nothing. It's God who's actually doing this. Now, nachnu ma is actually really very interesting because it means, and what are we? But they take it to mean, we are nothing, which is probably what it means. But at the same time, nachnu ma is a sound that sounds like man, right? In other words, the manna is actually there, nachnu ma, right? In other words, the what are we? We're just like the manna, right? This is it's really all of the only divine power that stands behind us, which is actually a really interesting sort of point. And I think that this midrash gets the idea right. Now let's take a look here and see about the heathen. So they're turning back to page 6. Okay, so if you can read from the middle there, we're right after the note for Psalm 22:7. Yeah, exactly.
For the heathens, it is not so. I bestowed greatness upon Nimrod, and he said, "Come, let us build a city."
Okay, so I want you to note here, Nimrod is considered to be in whose generation? He's in early in Genesis. So it's immediately afterwards. There's going to be a parallel between Nimrod and Abraham. In fact, the midrashically, the king who throws Abraham into the fiery furnace, not Daniel there, but actually Abraham, and kills his brother is Nimrod. And so you actually have here the example of Abraham from Genesis 18 compared or paralleled with the example of Nimrod from Genesis 11. Do you see that? And it's going to continue like that. And that's the next one.
The Lord
upon Pharaoh upon let's see but is city upon Pharaoh right
upon Pharaoh and he said, "Who is the Lord?"
Yes, that's what we just read. That's 5:2. Now you'll note again, right, Moses and Aaron, they say, "We're nothing." What does Pharaoh say? Right, "Mi Hashem," right? Who's this God you're talking about? Okay, you see that? Now next one.
Upon Sennacherib, and he said, who are they among all the gods of the country?
Right, so that's Kings, and who did we talk about before up above?
David,
that's exactly right. So there's this interesting parallel that's going on. And then what happens next?
Upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he said, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Upon Hiram, king of Tyre, and he said, I sit in the seat of God in the heart of the sea.
Okay, so right. So there we're past the parallels. Why are we past the parallels at that point? Because the final redemption has not yet come. Right? Which is actually very, very interesting. Okay, so fine. So go ahead.
Rabbah, others say, Rabbi Yochanan said, more significant is that which is said of Moses and Aaron than that which is said of Abraham. Of Abraham it is said, I am but dust and ashes. Whereas of Moses and Aaron it is said,
and we are nothing. Right, we are nothing, and we are nothing. Yeah, exactly right. I guess I killed that with the way that I killed the punchline with the way that the timing worked out with having to switch the page and everything. Right, but very clearly here, I want you to note that this midrash moves, or this passage moves completely away from the Egyptian context. Right, what are we really talking about here? We're talking about parallels that exist in history between certain kinds of leaders and other sorts of leaders, right? The leaders who are non-Jewish leaders are tyrants and arrogant. The leaders who are Jewish leaders are humble and submit themselves to the will of God, right? So that's actually what's going on in the two pieces. This is as close as I can come to a direct rivalry between Moses and Pharaoh, right? They're presented here as oppositions. And to some degree, that's actually what's going on in the movie. You've made this political point. Right? That in fact, what's going on here is the opposition between rule of men and rule of law, right? Which is actually really interesting. That's actually Thomas Mann's point in the novel, the Tablets of the Law, right? Pharaoh is a dictator. Remember when he's writing in 1944, right? And Moses and the power of God overcome the dictator. It's the power of law, the rule of law, that ultimately is identified as being sort of synonymous with the rule of God in the Thomas Mann novel. It's actually a really fascinating piece. So okay, so what's my point here ultimately, right? So my point here, I think, on one hand, is we get the Exodus story that we want to get, right? There's an American Exodus story here that's focused on the family drama on the one hand, right, and sort of the opposition of Moses and Ramses, and it's not present in the biblical text. It's just not there. But it's a need that we have. We seem to have a need for that kind of an oppositional plot, where you have two characters, an antagonist and a protagonist, who are connected by some deep connection and are in a state of struggle, which will ultimately be resolved in favor of the protagonist. That's how, right, Hollywood movies actually work and function. So I think that's fascinating. That's not the story in the book of Exodus. The story in the book of Exodus is about the power of God, how the power of God can overcome and defeat the most powerful superpower in the world at that time. Right. So, okay. So questions, thoughts, comments?
Actually, the biblical version presents Pharaoh more like the agent of God. So he's supposed to be there to say no.
Right,
to
God's tool.
To make it happen.
Yeah.
It has to be more and more stubborn until the whole thing breaks up.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
While you presented it as a family drama, so psychologizing it a little bit.
That's what the films are doing. Yeah, that's absolutely what the films are doing.
Right, but the Bible has the message, the historical message.
I'm not sure that it's a historical message. I think that you're right, that it's a message about how this king is the tool of God, right? In other words,
exactly.
that Laman harbot ototai bekirbo. I'm hardening his heart so that I can increase my signs.
Exactly.
At the same time, at a certain point, because there are two words that are used. One is two verbs that are used. One is kibadati, right? I am going to harden Pharaoh's heart. Kibadati et libo, right? Hichbadati libo or kibadati libo, one in the hifil, one in the pl. And you actually have another root that's actually used, hitchazek, right? We read that Pharaoh is going to harden his own heart or strengthen his own heart. So you actually do have, on the one hand, this idea of a Pharaoh as God's tool, and on the other hand, the idea of Pharaoh doing it himself to himself. Which is interesting.
He's playing the role that he's supposed to play. He's an actor in the drama.
I think that is what's going on. I think there are two conflicting traditions. There are two conflicting views of what's going on with Pharaoh. The text itself is at odds about what's going on with Pharaoh. On the one hand, he is God's tool. Absolutely he is. And on the other hand, he's a free actor. Because they want both things at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, so fine. So, yeah.
How do you reconcile what you said, that Pharaoh was a tyrant, and the early times of Moses in the desert doing to Israel what he did at least on Mount Sinai, you know?
Yes. Moses functions also like a person who's ruling not on the basis of law, but ruling on the basis of I am in charge here, and there are things I need to do in order to keep control of this sort of rebellious group of people.
Including killing
them, right? He not only that, but lying about what God actually says, right? Right. So when he actually gives that command to the Levites, he says to them, Ko Amar Hashem, this is what God has said, right? Simu ishkar bo al yerecho, right? The ivru betocha machaneh, right? Each person, God has said, go and get your swords, put them on your hips, and go through the camp and kill each man his kinsman, which is like wild, right? So, but God never said that, right? He's claiming that God said that in order to get the Levites to do this act, which is unimaginable.
Yeah, but he instructed them to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Right? We would never find that depiction in a Hollywood movie, would we? No. Because it's untenable for us. It's a kind of leadership that we can't possibly imagine as being positive. There are other moments like this as well, right? After the war with the Midianites, they bring back all of the women, and he says, "What did you do? You kept the women alive? How dare you? Put them to the sword right now!" And again, you'd never find that depiction in a Hollywood movie, unless you're depicting Moses as an anti-hero. Then you might actually find it. You actually do find sort of anti-hero kinds of things like that in movies. But yeah, Moses is a much more difficult character, than we actually imagine him being. Now, I guess I would say that there is an attempt to, on the part of biblical authors, to depict Moses as incredibly powerful and strong as a way of inspiring themselves. That the idea is that sometimes a leader has to act this way, and that becomes a kind of moment of self-justification as well. And yeah, you're right. I think that you're absolutely right. That the idea that Pharaoh is a tyrant and that Moses is a tyrant. If you want to put that into like a literary perspective, this is what he was raised to be. He was raised to be the Pharaoh of Egypt, right? And so this
well,
is what he right. Okay. So fine. So listen. You know, the Torah we have is the Torah we have. The question is not Moses should have done this or Moses should have done that. The question is, how do you understand Moses' actions in that context? Right? Do you see them as positive actions? Or clearly you see them as negative actions. But you see them as positive actions or negative actions. If you see them as negative actions, do you see that as a failure on Moses' part? What is God trying to do? Is God trying to lead Moses in a particular direction and Moses is failing? Well, we know that happens on multiple occasions, that Moses doesn't quite live up to what God's expectations are. So the question is this another case of that? Or is this something that the Torah is saying is a positive thing and that's the way you should act? And I am, again, unsure what we should take away from those stories. For me, the questions are much more important ultimately than the answers. But that's just me. I like questions. Yeah. Why don't we go 1-2?
You present the proposal of the two of them as people in leadership roles, and who has the more successful result?
Yeah.
And it wavers, but ultimately the more humble.
Yeah, that's the Talmud here. Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely. That's the Talmud's point, which makes sense because it's a rabbinic point of view, right? What's the ideal person rabbinically? The passive leader is much more the compassionate passive leader. The humble leader is ultimately the one who should continue to exist and persist. Our values, I think, and I think this is Ron's issue actually, our values are really rabbinic values. We don't like, what are the things that they like? They like humility, compassion, love, you know, passivity. Those are all the things that they love. What do they hate? They hate violence. They hate tyranny. They hate Rome, right, at the end of the day. And so any hint of Moses being like that, they're going to have to try and eliminate.
I'm not sure if there's so much passivity there, but, you know, because he ultimately, however he does it,
yeah,
he gets people to move forward.
He does get people to move forward.
With the aid of his team.
Right. No, that's absolutely correct. I think that rabbinic models of leadership, as opposed to biblical models of leadership, but I think rabbinic models of leadership are much more recessive. They're much more about consensus building ultimately than they are about sort of presenting strong. And you know, if I don't know there's a book that Danny Boyarin published, I want to say about 7, 8, maybe as much as 9 years ago now, called Unheroic Conduct, which is about an analysis of rabbinic conduct, where he makes the claim that they're constantly putting themselves in a depiction of their actions that in late antiquity would have been viewed as feminized, and that they are in a process of trying to adopt values that are seen by the Hellenistic world as values that are really part of, you know, sort of the women's world. They're adopting all of those sorts of values and compassion, consensus, all of those types of things. So they're really fascinating, interesting, and it's very compelling. I'm not sure if things are 100% the way he says they are, but boy, is it an interesting thesis. And it's a book that's worth reading. It's really a book that's worth reading. Yeah.
So, more just following up on that, why do you think the rabbinic compilers of the Haggadah felt the need to diffuse all of that human drama, all element of he's no character at all in the Haggadah.
That's right. He doesn't appear.
In passing one.
Well, there's one mention of Moses
right.
in the Haggadah, right? And there is one mention of Pharaoh in the Haggadah. It's just that mention of Pharaoh is very, very prominent, right? Most of the time, it's the Egyptians who are doing the oppression, rather than Pharaoh who's doing the oppression, which is actually really interesting. Whereas in the biblical account, it is Moses and Pharaoh who actually are in conflict with each other, and in fact, it's God who's in conflict with Pharaoh as well. which is really very interesting, right?
The whole idea of Moses as God's agent.
Yes.
In the Torah is absent from
absent,
the,
totally
it's,
absent.
It's God and no one else who did all of this.
Right.
Why is that? Why? Well,
the rabbinic midrash on that, right? Sort of, or I should say, the midrash. It's a common explanation for this is that when God turns to Moses after the incident with the golden calf, and he says, "Let me destroy them, and I'll make you into a great nation." Moses says, "Inkein mecheni na misifrecha asher kitasta." He says, "If that's the case, then I want you to erase me from your book." And the idea is that kind of a threat or a standing up to God at that moment, which is necessary, results in him not being written in the Haggadah. Right? God has erased him from the book. Right? And so the idea is that there's a kind of poetic justice to that, right? That in fact Moses is saying, you know, I'm not the one who's going to be the nation. It's Israel who's going to be the nation. And that's actually what's really good and important and the way things should be. And so this book, which is the book, you know, sort of Israel's response to the Exodus, actually doesn't include Moses. Or not really. It doesn't really include Moses. Yeah.
To answer Mark about a question is, maybe the reason is that we can establish the first commandment without mentioning Moses.
What was the first commandment? Anochi Hashem is what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Right. So that's fascinating. That is the first of the Aseret HaDibrot.
Right.
It's not the first mitzvah given to Israel.
No, I'm talking about the Aseret HaDibrot.
Yes. So but my question is, what is the first mitzvah that's given? Nope.
Chodesh
Azelechem, Rosh Chodeshim. And who does God give that commandment to? Right? It says that he's Vayomer Hashem leMoshe v'Aharon be'Eretz Mitzrayim leMor. Right? HaChodesh HaZelechem Rosh Chodeshim leChoshi Hashana. Right? The very first thing is the calendar, and the calendar is given to Moses and Aaron. Why? Because that establishes their leadership. The calendar is what establishes the person who's in charge politically, and that classically has been the case in Jewish tradition. And I think that's actually what's going on. Now, the first of the religious commandments that's given, right, sort of things that I think are beyond political, the first sacrificial commandment is the Korban Pesach. And then that actually does have resonance in terms of what our practice is, right? The Seder is a replacement for that Korban Pesach, for that Paschal sacrifice. Barry, you were going to say?
Yeah, so I think the defining event in Moses' life is when he leaves the palace and he sees the Jews being oppressed.
Yeah.
And he kills the Egyptian.
Yeah.
Or as contrast as the Buddha, he was a prince too.
That's fantastic.
When he saw the suffering in the world,
yeah,
he checked out.
That's
Moses
right.
Killed the guy.
Yeah.
And then I think the next step is he essentially does the city of refuge. The Midian is the city of refuge.
Yeah.
That's why I think he's not allowed back until the Pharaoh dies.
Oh, that's fantastic too. That's terrific.
That's really the way the city of refuge works. So he's now at best a manslaughterer. I mean, to take a look at it. I'm
yeah.
Not sure, sure he quite makes it as a man.
Yeah, yeah.
But we'll give him
the benefit of the doubt. Yeah.
But he's now back, coming back as a manslaughterer. I think the mysterious section where God goes to kill him on the way back,
mm-hmm.
and it's only with the blood
mm-hmm.
of the circumcision that
yeah.
saves him.
Yeah.
Is actually really the redemption of the blood that he spilled.
This is very. It's a very nice reading. It's a very nice reading. I think there's a part that's necessary to understand what Barry's talking about, which is that when the cities of refuge are actually described, the manslaughterer is supposed to stay in the cities of refuge until the death of the Kohen Gadol, until the death of the high priest, and that's what Barry's talking about in terms of the death of Pharaoh's death, right? Right. So I think it's fascinating, this idea of blood expiation. I think you've got, there's something there to that as well. It is interesting to note that the idea of rubbing blood is is what you have when Moses is going into Egypt and when he's coming out from Egypt as well. In other words, I think it's Brevard Childs who points this out, that the legs, which is where the blood is, where Tzipora rubs the blood, actually are constructed in the same way that a doorway is constructed. And that actually what's going on when you talk about sort of this moment of rubbing on blood, it's that there's a chiastic structure to the entire Exodus. He goes in, you know, through this doorway that's covered in blood, and he comes out through this doorway that's covered in blood, which is like a really interesting thing. And so then it's a portal. And I think you might be right about the blood expiation. So I'll say this: Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer actually makes the claim that since the commandment for circumcision is necessary, you have to be circumcised before you can eat the Korban Pesach, that all the Israelites are uncircumcised, that they have to circumcise themselves before the Paschal offering in Egypt. And what happens is they mix the blood of the lamb with the blood of circumcision and then wipe that on the doorposts, which is a real connection between the kind of expiation that you're talking about, between the two different kinds of bloods. I'll also just say one more thing. I was reading a passage today with my students that's at the very end of the 19th chapter of Shabbat in the Talmud, where it's talking about circumcision, and it has different brachot for circumcision of a baby versus circumcision of a convert. And it calls the circumcision of a convert dam brit. It is the blood of the covenant. But that word dam brit is actually the word that's used in Exodus at Mount Sinai when Moses sacrifices all of these animals and sprinkles blood on the people from the sacrifices to induct them into the covenant. And so there is this kind of like ongoing conflation between I think you're right, the circumcision as an act of sacrifice. And at its, I'm going to say one last thing, and this is really over the top, but you've inspired me. I don't know if you know this, but the book of Deuteronomy says that you cannot offer an animal as a sacrifice until it's 8 days old. And that, in fact, right, there is some level at which you can read circumcision in the Bible as anthropologically as a replacement for child sacrifice, which is very difficult and hard to deal with, and all of those things. But it's also fascinating, and those are the kinds of things that actually I find the troubling things are the things that I find inspiring. Yeah, let's say it that way.
And both the half shekel and as one mechanism for dealing with that, but also you could see circumcision the same way, because all taking of life and blood has to be expiated in some way.
With blood, yes.
And so this is potentially a mechanism in anticipation of
that. Fascinating. Fascinating. Okay. So we're of the same camp, I think, and that's I find what you're saying absolutely fascinating and worth thinking about. I'm not sure about that last one. I have to think about that more. I've not thought about it in that way in the past, but I'm open to it. Let's say it that way. I'm definitely open to it. It's really interesting. If nothing else, let's say it that way. Yeah.
Changing direction.
Yes.
One of the interesting things in the movie is, and particularly the 1920s, is the introduction of the son who is going to be killed.
Yeah.
And in the 1920s movie, you know, he's a naughty boy. And I'm curious if there are also midrashim about
the son who dies. Okay, so I think that it is fascinating that in the 19th, so films, in the same way that books talk to other books, films talk to other films. And so in the 1920s version, he has that kid there at the beginning to establish it, because the very next scene is going to be, the death, kid's death. And so he wants him there. What happens is that poignant moment continues through all of the other movies. It's there in the 1950s Ten Commandments. It's there in A Prince of Egypt, and it's there also again in Exodus, Gods and Kings. And
but only the 1920s made him such a naughty child.
Right. Well, so he kicked.
Or created a tension.
Yes.
Where he's trying to protect himself from Moses.
Well, so yes, it's true. He does it of his own volition in the 1920s version, but he kicks Moses again in the 1950s, and he tries to hide out under his with his mother in the 50s also. She's like, I want to say that I forget what they call her. They call her Nefertiti. I forget what they call the character, but she is really a 50s paragon of womanhood, right? In other words, she's like the homemaker and all of those things, which is like really fascinating that they put her in the movie. The fact that there's a rivalry in terms of this sort of love triangle also was really interesting, and that continues in the other movies also. Completely absent, totally absent character that's completely absent. I think that there are as you say, certain tropes, right, that are here that continue. You mentioned before this trope of rule of law and this kind of political trope. This is another trope I think that exists, which is the trope of this kind of nuclear family and the fact that there's going to be this poignant moment where the kid dies. And I think that moment is designed to create sympathy for the villain, which is another thing that at least in English literature, we have a long tradition of. We are in Anglo-Saxon writing, we try to be sympathetic to our villains. Well, you know, the devil is a much more interesting and sympathetic character in Paradise Lost than any of the other characters. Right. Okay. Thank you very much. This is another pleasure. This is a fantastic thing. And I'd like to do this again. Can we do this again?
With movies.
I don't know if I'm going to do the movies again, but I think it was great. I think it really worked. It really worked. A good Pesach, a decent Pesach. Kasher umato. I don't know. You're not going to be able to see the movies on the